Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
Gabe, you got an email.
This is from Warren. Let me get it going on my phone here. He writes, in your discussion about the possible use of the ring as a means of male contraception, we had our colleague Aline Spantig in here last week.
Yeah, this was a new device that is made of rubber or silicone and that men can, in theory, wear around their genitalia to decrease the quality of the sperm through heat. That's the idea. There is no data to support the idea that this specific device works. But the open question from Warren was...
Warren was wondering, he wrote, I wonder if thermal regulation already exists. Has a study of fertility been done comparing males who wear briefs to those that wear boxer shorts? Absolutely. There have been a number of those studies, the biggest of which was done at Harvard in 2018, looking at 656 men and what kind of underwear they wear and the effect that that has on their fertility.
Probably college kids here.
Yeah, those 656 between the ages of 32 and 39.
Oh, okay, yeah. Not college kids.
Yeah. They completed a survey that included questions about the style of underwear they wore in the previous 3 months, and the options were boxers, briefs, and bikini. I was not aware of the third option. Bikini is something like...
Oh.
Like that. I got a picture. I printed out a picture.
It's like, okay, but it's even skinnier
it's
than...
It's skinnier than your normal brief.
Yeah, it looks like a Speedo, like a swimmer who would be in a race, a really tiny, tight Speedo, kind of. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so among the study participants, 53% reported usually wearing boxers. And for those men wearing boxers, 25% higher sperm concentrations, 17% higher total sperm counts, and higher motility. And that's really important. That's the ability for sperm to swim and get through the female reproductive tract and fertilize the egg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you're trying to get pregnant, boxers are the way to go. Anything that,
no doubt,
that and anything at all that either pulls your testes closer to your body or warms them, the laptop effect, if you're working with a laptop and it's sitting on your lap and that battery or electrical heat seeps down into your lap, all of that will reduce the chances of a successful...
Completely maladaptive. Yep.
Yeah, successful pregnancy. I'm just going to jump... I'm going to do kind of one single topic because there was so much science on sleep that happened to be published this week or have come out recently enough and everyone's kind of talking about it this week.
Okay.
First one, wonderful study and data set. It's on... I'll just go ahead and kind of tell you what the conclusion is. The conclusion is that brighter nights and darker days predict higher mortality risk. That's actually not even the conclusion. That's a title. It was published in PNAS and study done out of Texas, but it was based on UK Biobank data. I think something like 90,000 people were looked at.
Okay, so the brighter it is at night and the darker it is during the day means that you're going to be sleeping?
Means that your mortality risk goes up.
Okay.
Your chances of living longer go down.
Because you're not sleeping as well.
That's probably connected to sleep quality. They weren't looking specifically at that.
Well, the circadian clock, right?
It
is a product of those things that you just mentioned, how bright it is at night and how dark it is during the day.
Exactly. And connected to the idea of circadian amplitude. So how the greatest difference between the darkness you experience and the brightness on a given day or in a given time frame. So if you're spending all day long inside a dark house or living room and never going outside, you're not going to have a very high circadian amplitude. So here, what they're suggesting is that if you want to remain healthy, the best thing you can do, I mean, it's kind of confirming what we all know, natural light, but also at the right times of the day and also darkness at the right times of the day. You've talked about that with smartphone usage late at night. Try not to do it or use filters. Mm-hmm. This is what I like a lot about this data is not just the fact that they had nearly 100,000 people, 88,000 people involved, and 13 million hours of data. It was based on a watch or a light sensor worn around the wrist and not on self-reporting. So there've been, that's what they say in the paper. They're like,
So no way to fudge the data then?
Yeah. They
or get it wrong.
They say something along the lines of, you know, others have done this before. They've looked at this before, but it was self-reporting. They use satellite information. How much sunlight was there actually there? Ground level measurements. They also looked at skin cancer rates. this one, something on your wrist to measure how much light is coming in or how much light is not coming in. And the healthiest you can be is to have bright light throughout the day. And then when it's time to sleep, you have darkness. That's going to keep you healthiest.
And all the way to mortality, death.
Yes.
How do they determine that?
Well, I'm not sure that this is necessarily a case of causation, and I don't think they claim that. It could be that if you're ill already, you're not going outside, and hence the light fluctuation is low. But if you're healthy, this would be an indication to, at the very least, try to live a lifestyle that keeps your circadian rhythm happy, healthy, and well. Next one, real quick here. Got a couple of them. I'll do these fast. Gabe, would you say you're more lunar phobic or lunar philiac?
That I like the moon?
Yeah. Are you more scared of the moon, or are you more a fan of the moon?
I am not at all scared of it. I'm a fan of the moon.
Good. Yeah. No, I love the moonlight.
Lunophiliac. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of us are like that. A lot of large animals are like that. And a lot of smaller animals are not.
Huh.
Because the moon provides enough light that if you're the type of animal that can be eaten by predators.
For them to get attacked.
Exactly. And so that much has been known for quite a while. What hasn't been known is, what if, does it have an effect in areas that don't really get any moonlight anyway? Can it still have kind of knock-on effects or even direct measurable effects? And what they did here for this study is they used camera trapping data from 17 forests, 3 continents, total of 86 mammal species, where it's dark down there. They have a huge tree canopy. The lunar phase doesn't really matter. It's dark down there, and yet for half of the mammal species, it still matters. They still react to it,
even though they don't really see the moon.
Right.
Okay.
So some light, something is getting through.
Yeah.
Or maybe on the outskirts. I don't know if there are openings, clearings nearby where the animals would be in a more agitated state, and that's communicated back. I don't know how that works, but it's still having an impact there. And the purpose of this research, why even look at that, is that if you clear some of those trees unnaturally, you log it, you get rid of it, you're increasing the risk that the mostly smaller rodents, but all sorts of animals then will have to completely change their behavior because the risk has changed, obviously, because of this moonlight.
They'll have to move to a different part of the forest where there's no light getting through.
Exactly. Yeah. Now they're all collected there. And now you have a completely different ecosystem. And last thing, this one's for humans, also connected to moonlight. A study, I guess we're returning back to Texas here, and it is specific to Texas. But one of the animals that didn't necessarily change its behavior, in fact, I believe they went out more often, were the artiodactyls. I had to look that up. That was new to me. These are hoofed mammals. So they have hooves. So they bear weight on 2 of their 5 toes. It could be deer, llamas, sheep, goats, cattle, whatever.
Got it.
They don't mind the moonlight because, generally speaking, they're not going to get attacked by moonlight. Well, this was a paper published in Transportation Research that said, watch out if you're a human driver and it's a full moon, because those animals are...
Because they're running around.
Yeah, there are far more...
Artiodactyls.
far more artiodactyls involved in wildlife vehicle collisions on full moon nights when compared to new moon, so no moon nights. So if you're out driving, I think the number goes up by 45%. Mm-hmm. If there's a full moon out, it's probably a beautiful time to drive. I've driven on nights like that. It's great. Just know that animals are more active, and in particular, the animals that could end up flying over your hood and through the windshield, harming you, killing the animal. Hopefully not killing you, but just be careful out there. Data was, I think, 1,000 collisions between 2011 and 2020 from Texas.
I got one about driving. This one's about kids, 16-year-olds or between 16 and 17. So people who have had their license in the United States, you get your license at 16.
I was going to say, here in Germany, it's 18, which feels more reasonable. And really a lot of driver's education happening before you get that license. My wife, it's just one example. I think between 40 and 50 hours of supervised driving, not by her parents, this is by a driving instructor, before she got her license here in Germany. They take it very seriously here.
Takes a long time and costs a lot.
It's expensive, yeah.
These 119 kids probably didn't put that time or money into their license. They've had it for less than 12 months, and they were wearing a smartphone telematics app.
Telematics.
That is, essentially, it's a surveillance device for when you're driving. And it looked at, in the end, 12,000 different trips taken by these 119 kids to look at, really, what percent of the time they had their hands on a device, a smartphone device. 34% of all those trips, the kids had, or these 16-year-olds, had a phone in their hands for an average of 2.1 minutes, right? So the distraction is there. What it was also looking at was what's known as kinematic risky driving events, which is when you have to slam the brakes or rapid acceleration. And the association between the kids who had their hands on a device and these kinematic risky driving events was through the roof. So this is telling us right here, if you've got your phone in your hand, it will cause risky driving events. Of these 12,000 trips, no accidents happened, which is a good thing.
Wow, good.
Which is a good, a great thing.
Smartphones are directly responsible for a lot of car accidents.
So is speeding. So the other thing, or the other kind of driving that this app was looking for, was speeding. In 43% of the trips, there was speeding happening.
How do they define it? Because I just got a ticket in the mail for speeding. Here in Germany, they've got these little photographic stations set up, and it really made me angry because it's one of those ones I feel is immoral and unethical. They have like a 100-yard section of road that they have dropped down to 50 kilometers an hour, so 30 miles an hour, just for that section, just to get you. I think
going above the limit, not a certain amount above the limit.
Because here in Germany, I believe if you're going to get, this is what I've heard, if you're going to get ticketed, like, you have the photo taken of you. And the last one, I just got this 2 days ago in the mail.
Has to be 6 kilometers per hour over, right?
I think 10%.
10%.
Oh, I'm getting, our German technician just held three digits up at me. Okay, so we just got some
technical difficulties. We were just instructed by our studio engineer, Thomas Schmidt, that it is 3 kilometers per hour over, not six. Sorry about that. For all our German listeners.
Yeah, well, it's.
Or people heading to Germany, be aware it's 3 kilometers over the limit. You're getting a ticket in the mail.
Yeah, we kind of bring this up a lot, but it's a huge misconception about Germany. I feel like people come over here and they want to rent one of, you know, Germany's various supercars for a couple of days and take it out on the Autobahn and just absolutely rip down the Autobahn, thinking that there's no speed limit anywhere. There are lots of speed limits in many different places, and the quote-unquote tolerance for going over, you know, it might be 100 kilometers an hour, 120, is very low, and they have these photographic stations. Again, not the point of the study at all.
The point of the study, to get back to it, is that 34% of all these 12,000 trips, the kids had their phone in their hands, and 43% of the trips, they were speeding. Why does this matter? The New England Journal of Medicine last year did a study on what leads to accidents, and the likelihood of getting in an accident when you are distracted with your phone in your hands is a factor of 4, and for speeding, close to 10. So those are the two things to think about for all our young listeners out there. I don't know what the average age of the people listening to this program are, but if you've just gotten your license, don't speed, and do not look at your phone. Don't text, don't call, don't dial a phone, because that will increase the likelihood that you're going to get into an accident.
That's a very good takeaway that I think even our cautious listeners will have a tough time implementing. If my two eyeballs looking around the road while I drive are any indication, there are so many people on their phones. At night in particular, you can see the light illuminating the interior of their vehicle while driving, certainly at stoplights, and you'll know who's on their phone because the light turns green and then they're still.
Watch them go by my street. We unfortunately bought a house on a very busy street, and I watch them speeding by and looking at their phones, and it makes my blood boil.
Boil.
I don't know if it actually boils, but I get really angry.
Check your smartphone occasionally while driving? That's kind of, it's a hard question to ask. It's a hard one to answer, honestly, because a lot of us do a quick flick or think, okay, just this once. Do you do it? And when?
And would you ever maybe not change your behavior? Because these things are modifiable. That was the point of the study. These are modifiable things. You can change them and it will save lives.
Let us know. SU@DW.com.
Thank you. Connor, you got more maps on the desk. I mean, I've been doing this podcast with you for how long now? 5 years?
Yeah.
I've never seen so many maps on your desk.
They don't have,
as right now.
They don't have anything to do with what we're about to talk about, really.
Although what do they have to do?
It's the four trips that Christopher Columbus took between the years of 1492 and I think 1506 was the last one. And when I started researching this topic, that's what caught my attention, is the four trips. You always hear about the one, mm-hmm. 1492.
Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
And yet there were four different trips. And there's a logic to them. I'm not going to get into that now. Again, it's not the point. To the way that first the Bahamas and then Cuba and then what we would today call the Dominican Republic and Haiti were first discovered, and then later looping around south to the tip of South America and then over to Central America, the East Coast, and figuring out what the Caribbean was. It fascinates me. Yeah. That whole time enthralls me. And to talk a little bit about that, kind of tangentially today, is...
The question is, who was Christopher Columbus? Yeah. We've got Matthew Ward Aegis, our Australian ringer, in studio with us today to answer that, or...?
Well, as best as I can.
Yeah.
As best as I can.
This is premised on you having looked into recently 4DW.
Yeah.
I was going to say a new study, because that's usually what we say here. It wasn't exactly a new study into the origins of Christopher Columbus. What was it exactly?
Well, it is a good story into how scientists define science and good science, and how the rest of the world and the rest of the media might define science as well. So you're right. We'd normally talk about studies. You guys would normally talk about studies on this show, but this is not published research yet. It's not been peer reviewed. It's not been put in a journal. It's been a claim. It is a claim broadcast on Spanish public television in a documentary about Christopher Columbus, his DNA, and the true story.
Who made the claim?
A research team from the University of Granada, which is in Spain.
I spent a semester there. I know this place very well.
Okay.
That caught my interest.
By all accounts, a very nice part of the world.
Culture shock for me going to the university, because it was going to a European university for the first time, quite mm-hmm. different than what I had known back mm-hmm. in my home city of Seattle.
Mm-hmm. But and researchers there claim to know...
Yes. So 20 years ago, they had what they believed to be a sample of Christopher Columbus's DNA from his purportedly buried remains in the Cathedral of Seville, which is another town in Spain. And they wanted to confirm it. They wanted to confirm whether or not it was actually him. They had some recorded DNA from his brother and his son as, I guess, reference material. You know, the backstory is that it wasn't perhaps clear where Christopher Columbus ended up after his passing. So he originally wanted to be buried on the island of Hispaniola, mm-hmm. which is in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm. Today's Dominican Republic and Haiti.
Yep. And so that took place. That was something that happened. The remains were taken there. He was buried. But then, because of various geopolitical conflicts over the ensuing centuries, those remains fell into the possession of other regimes, other countries, other colonial powers, and was moved around and then supposedly taken to the cathedral in Seville. They wanted to test if that was the case. And in this documentary, they came back and said, yes, these are his remains, as has been believed by historians for a very long time. He ended up here, in effect.
And out of the dust in this paper, did it match the other family members? Do we know where Christopher Columbus was
not,
from?
Not even a paper. Documentary.
We're going
on. Documentary.
So these are, this is all documentary.
Got it.
Presentation. Yes, so that's what they've claimed about where he's ended up. At the same time, there has been dispute for a long time about the true identity of Christopher Columbus, because the sort of conventionally accepted point of history is that he was a Genovese man from Italy in Genoa, however you want to pronounce it, whether you're from Italy or literally everywhere else, we'll just say Genoa. Yeah. But that has been disputed. It has been suggested that he might have been Spanish, that he might have been Portuguese. It's been suggested that he might have been Greek, maybe even British. All these different sort of origin countries had been speculated about by historians, as historians tend to do, and funnily enough, with very high-profile historic figures. So they wanted to find out, well, was he actually from Italy, what we would call modern-day Italy, or what was an individual state in terms of Genova.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And from his DNA, they would be able to determine
that.
And
they've come back in this documentary and said, well, actually, it's plausible. He wasn't. But without, Italian, and I suppose this is the point, that it was reported that a new scientific study has found. That is the way it had been reported across many reputable media outlets. The point in terms of the experts that I spoke to, and probably the thing that flagged with me the moment it came across my desk during the aftermath of this documentary being screened, is that, well, it's only been a documentary, and as we know, the word study in a scientific sense generally speaks to a journal article that's been reviewed by independent scientists, by that, of course, you know, independent of the actual research undertaken.
Of course.
And that hasn't happened yet. So these are really just claims on TV. They might have been made by, you know, highly qualified forensic experts, which is who this, or what these two individuals who are from the forensics department at the University of Granada have led this study. By all accounts, there were collaborations with the University of North Texas in the US and with the University of Florence in Italy. I tried to reach out to those institutions to verify that. They haven't been able to do so as yet. And in fairness to those institutions and their press offices, that's because I have very little information to go on beyond a 2021 press release from the University of Granada saying we will collaborate with laboratories in these places, without naming who or what those laboratories are. So there's not a lot of information to actually go to get to the point of verifying this. I reached out to the lead researchers and to the University of Granada's press office to try and get comment about some of these questions. They did get back to me with a statement just before we went to publish, and they said that it was always agreed that we would present our findings in this documentary. And that is true. In 2021, in the material put out by the University of Granada, they said it will first be presented in a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
They then said it will be published both in 2021 and in this statement that I was provided by the lead researchers. It will be published in an international journal. But there has not been indicated what that journal will be. And as we know, that can be a very, very reputable journal, or it can be an internationally circulated journal of less repute. We just don't know. That they will present their findings at a press conference in November, a date to be confirmed. And there is a reason for that being delayed, and that's they're doing some final verification on what they described as some key points of scientific and historical interest. To your question, Gabe, could you determine that someone had Jewish ancestry, a person that has been dead for 500 years, if you had a good quality DNA sample, the independent experts I spoke to about this said, well, yes, it is plausible that you can, but you need to understand that we are trying to apply a scientific, you know, in a scientific study, you sort of naturally go to these ideas of certainties. But if we think about, say, if you undertook an ancestry DNA test with the company Ancestry, I think there's 23andMe, mm-hmm. and companies like this, that they say, we'll take a spit sample and we'll tell you where you come from. I mean, there are an entire TV series called Who Do You Think You Are that is based around this premise. And when you do those tests, it will sort of give you a geographic region. You know, you've got X percent that comes from Eastern Europe, and you've got X percent that comes from the Middle East, and it can drill down a little bit more geographically. But all that really is doing is comparing your autosomal DNA, so the 22 chromosomes, genetic information from the 22 chromosomes that you sort of inherit from both of your parents, not your sex chromosomes, not your X or your Y, depending on your birth sex. And what that is basically doing is saying, we've got all these patterns in your autosomal DNA, and they match people that kind of live here now. So we know that you're sort of from this area, genetically speaking. This study supposedly uses mitochondrial DNA, so inherited on the from the maternal line. So your mother's, 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 and so on. The moment a male comes into the equation, that mitochondrial DNA gets cut off. So this is purely and simply every woman that goes back each time gave you this. So you didn't get any mitochondrial DNA from your father's side, for instance, nor from your mother's father's side. It has to be female all the way. And the Y chromosome, so the opposite, every man that led to you in order in an unbroken line. So the argument that the experts I spoke to is, well, this isn't really great for being able to say this person is a person of Jewish ancestry, because we usually use this sort of DNA to go back to very ancient populations. We're talking thousands of years, not tens or hundreds. And that is going back to large populations and often used to try and understand the migration of the human species across massive geographical areas in time and space.
I was going to say, typically all the way back to the Eve or the original, the mother of
correct,
ultimately Homo sapiens.
Correct. It was, I'll get the numbers wrong, the seven daughters of Eve, I want to say. Mm. It was a very high profile piece of genetic publication some time ago. And so this is sort of what the experts I spoke to said. Yeah, look, we haven't seen a paper to verify this information. We can't confirm or refute that Christopher Columbus was a man of Jewish ancestry, because we haven't seen the data that's been used here.
And just to kind of summarize this up then, a sensational new claim made on TV to coincide with Columbus Day, to get maximal attention, for which we don't have any evidence to look at ourselves or for other scientists to corroborate, either corroborate or to debunk at this point.
But it could be coming soon?
Well, it sounds like
the evidence.
It sounds like it in some shape or form. But even then, a press conference is not a peer-reviewed paper. And, you know, I'm sure that in the many years that you've done this podcast, you guys have spoken about the flaws of peer review often and regularly debated within the scientific professions.
Yeah, during the coronavirus pandemic, that was a big topic.
What are you allowed to talk about?
Because the point was to get studies out fast, and that whole peer review process slowed things down.
But the idea, I suppose, that is the current gold standard of independent verification of research. Until we get that in some shape or form, you know, the ultimate form of verification would be to provide the samples for independent laboratories to be able to say, yeah, we agree with the statements you've put out. Until such, you know, that sort of journey towards verification, until then, it's hard to say.
Boy, a lot to unpack here.
Yeah, well, but there's something useful for anyone who is listening at this point. You're about to hear at a public event a huge declaration on the origins of Christopher Columbus. Take it with a grain of salt based on what you've heard right now, because there are very open questions about it. And Matt, thanks for coming in today. And
my pleasure.
Explaining why some of them are very open.
What do you guys have to say based on listening to this? Get in touch with us at su@dw.com. Thanks, Matt.
Science.
Cheers.
Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.